quietly exploring the farthest reaches of the causes and conditions of the present moment. The causes and conditions that are present at a moment of presence and awakeness. We have this issue in today's stories about causes and conditions and awakening. For those just arriving, we're on the second day of Genzoe Sesshin, exploring valley sounds, mountain colors. Shobo Genzo Keisei Sanshoku, celebrating the stories of these Zen ancestors awakening through nature expressing itself just as it is. The inevitability of nature doing its thing and seeing that directly. So yesterday we had the poem of the poet Su Dongpo, hearing at night the sound of the valley stream as the Buddha's long, broad tongue, and seeing the color of the mountains as the Buddha's pure body, hearing 84,000 verses. What could he say to explain this the next day? And we have now another story. Dogen tells three different stories about people awakening to the way through direct experience of nature. So we're at the bottom of page one. Does everyone have a copy of this?
We don't have any. We don't have copies of them.
You can just listen along too. We'll read through. So, Xiang Yan Shi Xiang. Xiang Yan Zhi Xiang studied at the assembly of Guishan Lingyo Zen Master Dayuan on Mount Gui. So, Xiang Yan studied with Guishan. Guishan was founder of one of the five houses of Zen, the Guiyan House, really important golden age Zen teacher. Xiang Yang means fragrance of dignity, or like fragrant sternness. Xiang Yang, Xiang Yang. So Guishan said to him, his student, "You are bright and knowledgeable. Say something about yourself before your parents were born, but don't use words you've learned from sutras and commentaries." Remember yesterday we had this story about the teaching of the insentient. And Dongshan's teacher saying, "I can't say it to you with the mouth born of father and mother. I can't explain to you with the mouth born of father and mother." Now here the question is, say something about before your mother and father were born. Before your mouth born, a father and mother was born, and before they were born. Classic Zen koan to take up as a meditative investigation. What was your original face before your parents were born? So this is the question. You're bright and knowledgeable. Say something about yourself before your parents were born, but don't use words that you've learned from sutras and commentaries. Xiangyan was widely studied in the sutras and commentaries. He understood the teachings of Buddhadharma very well. So if he didn't add that little addendum there, he probably could have done quite well. Let me just go to the before parents were born chapter. And I'll look it up just a minute. Xiangyan tried and tried, but could not say anything. He could not express himself. He pored through the many books he had collected over the years, but could not come up with anything. Deeply ashamed or regretting body and mind of the present, he burned his books and said, "A painting of a rice cake does not satisfy hunger." You know that saying, "A painting of a rice cake does not satisfy hunger." Dogen writes a whole chapter on the painting of a rice cake, questioning whether maybe it can satisfy hunger in Dogen's own unique understanding of that. But the classical image, right, is that written words are not gonna can't ultimately help us. You have to actually eat the Dharma, swallow it whole. That sticky, warm rice cake, you have to chew again and again in order to digest it. You have to really chew it up, but then swallow it, and it's very nourishing. But the painting of a rice cake, a picture of a rice cake, that won't nourish you, right? And you won't be able to chew it. So wonderfully. So all these books he collected were like painted rice cakes, but they don't really satisfy his true hunger. So he burned them. It's Daido Lori's commentary. He tries to do like kind of classical line by line verse commentaries. So to this story, which is one of Dogen's 300 koans, Daido Lori says to this line something like, "This burning his books is like kicking your car when it doesn't start." That's it. Most of his commentaries sound like they could just be like out of the Tang Dynasty or something, but that was a kind of fresh, modern image. In other words, like, it's maybe going a bit far. Maybe you didn't really have to burn the books up, right? Just say, "Well, let me go deeper." But it's kind of like blaming the books, right, that he doesn't understand. These useless things, get rid of them, burn them up. So he burned the books, saying, "A painted rice cake doesn't satisfy hunger. I will be just a gruel-making monk, not expecting to understand Buddhadharma in this lifetime." So there's various interpretations of this gruel-making. Literally it says something like, doing gruel and rice. Gruel is like rice cereal. We might say like breakfast and lunch. Doing oatmeal and rice. So So then people interpret doing as making it or begging for it. But most common interpretation is serving. I would just be oatmeal and rice serving monk, which some of you are doing in this sesshin very kindly. Thank you. It's a kind of like humble position of just offering, very very great spirit actually, and ashamed of thinking that he had all this knowledge that would help him to express himself freely, and it not working. He said, "Forget all that. Let me just accumulate more merit," we might say. Just serve breakfast and lunch, and not expecting to understand Buddha Dharma in his lifetime, or not seeking to understand. Basically, we could take that as a kind of defeatist thing, like, I'll never get it, so I'll just like serve rice now. Or it might be more like, I'm not going to try to figure this out anymore. A more positive, less defeat-like spirit, but more like surrender, true surrender of like, I'm not going to seek to figure out this Dharma anymore. I'm just going to serve beings. The great Bodhisattva spirit. Kind of implying too that, at least one version of the story says that at this point, you know, tears were flowing. He was crying in his frustration and had a kind of turn of practice, right? No longer trying to figure this out. I'm going to give up seeking Dharma. A gruel-making or gruel-serving monk means one who supports the assembly by cooking or serving rice, an equivalent of a kitchen assistant or a waiter, most translations say, in our country. He followed this vow for years. So we could also say the Tenzo has this spirit, right, of serving the assembly very kindly and humbly, just skipping some, missing some of the zazen practice in order to serve us and nourish us in this way, quietly cooking the food and the server serving it. One day, Xian Yan said to Guishan, "My body and mind is undifferentiated or clouded. I cannot speak. Can you speak for me, Master? Or can you say something to help me?" Guishan said, "I wouldn't mind explaining it to you, but if I did, you would resent me in the future." So first he's looking for answers in the sutras and commentaries and can't find them, gives that up. And then he goes to his teacher and says, I can't find anything to say about who I was before my parents were born. Can you just give me a hint to help me a little bit here? Say something to help me." And his teacher also, nothing. He gets nothing. Even though his teacher wouldn't mind explaining it to me, but if I did, you would resent me in the future. If I tell you, then you'll just say, "Oh, finally, I got it now. I'm satisfied." And you won't go further. You won't investigate further if I explain this. You'll just relax, satisfied that you got an answer. Sometime later, Xiang Yan went to the memorial site of Nanyang National Teacher Da Jung on Mount Wudang and built himself a hut. For company, he planted some bamboo. One day, while he was sweeping the path, a pebble flew up and struck a bamboo. the unexpected sound, Xianyan had a thorough awakening. After bathing and cleansing himself, he faced Mount Gui, where his teacher lived, on a distant mountain, offered incense, prostrated himself, and said to his distant teacher, "Master, if you had spoken for me at that time, this could not have happened now. Your kindness is deeper than my parents." So he thanked him for that frustrating conversation from long before, where his teacher wouldn't give him some help. Then he wrote a poem, "One Stroke Dissolves Knowledge." One stroke, one strike of a pebble on a bamboo dissolves knowledge. Knowledge is like a mind that knows something outside itself. That whole setup dissolves. Struggle no longer needed. I will follow the ancient path, not lapsing into quietude. Or other ways to put it would be like not lapsing into idle function. Or one interpretation is even not lapsing into doubt. Like, I'm finished with doubt. Noble conduct beyond sound and form. This is noble conduct or dignified activity. Iwigi, we have a Shobogenzo, Shobutsu Iwigi, like I think Taigen translates it as awesome presence. Dignified conduct or awesome presence beyond sound and form, beyond sound and color, no trace anywhere. Those who have mastered the way may call this an unsurpassable activity, or unsurpassable working. It's that word key, like pivot, working, function, dynamic function, unsurpassable dynamic function. He presented this poem to Guishan, who said, "This fellow has gone through," or "This fellow is complete," or "has penetrated the matter." So, similar to Sudong Po on the Mount Lushan at night, hearing the sound of the valley stream, as the Buddha's Dharma body, tongue, that stream reciting thousands of sutra verses in its own unique non-human language, the language of the insentient. Here too, the pebble striking the bamboo. In that one instant is 84,000 Dharma verses of the insentient. So, yeah, a little bit about Xianyan. So there's Andy Ferguson's book here. He tells the same story. Of course, there's always slight variations. Even in the Chinese originals, they get passed down in separate streams. So you get these interesting little twists. But it's basically the same. In this case, he wasn't sweeping, but he was scything grass. So here the story happens. The pebble strikes the bamboo. He writes the poem. He bows in the direction of his teacher. And then, you know, in this story, it doesn't say, well, how did his teacher hear about this? That he presented this poem to Guishan. Right, well, did he go back there? In this case, Xian Yan then dispatched a monk to take the verse to Guishan and recite it. So he didn't go himself. It was a long journey, and he didn't want to bother like going on long journeys anymore because he was done seeking Dharma. So he's like, you know, if you're going over by Mount Gui, take this poem to my teacher, would you? And upon hearing it, Guishan said to Yangshan, his other student, Yangshan's a Dharma brother of Xian Yan, our hero here. The Guiyang school is based on these two in particular, Guishan and Yangshan, many conversations they had. So Guishan said to his student, staying with him there, Yangshan, this disciple has penetrated, or has gone through. Yangshan said, the student said to his teacher who said that, this is a good representation of mind function, but wait, and I'll personally go and check out Xian Yan's realization myself. So he's kind of like skeptical. Later, Yangshan met with Xian Yan, so he went to go check him out and said, Master Guishan, you know, our mutual teacher, has praised the great matter of your awakening. What do you say as evidence for it? Xian Yan then recited his previous verse, which he'd already heard, right? You know. He had burned all of his sutras and commentaries, but he framed the verse and hung it on the wall of his grass hut. This is my Dharma verse. And it's true.
One trick pony.
Yep. Yep. Yangshan said, this verse could be composed from the things you studied earlier. If you had genuine enlightenment, then say something else to prove it. He's not satisfied. You probably collected the lines of this verse from those sutra commentaries, didn't you? Xian Yan then composed a verse, a fresh new verse, that said, last year's poverty was not real poverty. This year's poverty is finally genuine poverty. In last year's poverty, there was still some ground where I could plant my hoe. In this year's poverty, not even the hoe remains. So, Yangshan, his Dharma brother, very scrutinizing, said, okay, I grant that you have realized the Zen of the Tathagatas, Tathagata Zen, but as for the Zen of the ancestors, you haven't seen it even in your dreams. So this is a common little thing that came out of Zen in these days, was distinguishing Tathagata Zen and ancestor Zen. Maybe just briefly, we could say something like Tathagata Zen is like the Buddha's Zen, like as understood in the Buddha's sutras and so on. Pretty good, right? Tathagata Zen. But then ancestor Zen ancestor Zen is like outside the Tathagata's scriptures. And it's about direct expression. So he's just pushing him. Yes.
Did you say that these two became very close later and established some sort of school or something?
Well, it's more Yangshan, who's having a conversation with his Dharma brother, the one who heard the pebble, Yang Shan and his teacher, Gui Shan, it's not so much that they formed, that they like decided to form a school together, it's more like there are so many recorded conversations about that particular teacher and student that instead of calling it the Gui Shan house, like it's the Gui Yang house, it's teacher and disciple, just like Soto, or in Chinese, Cao Dong. Sometimes it's said to be the house, one of the five houses of Dongshan and his disciple, Cao Shan, because they also had a lot of conversations, particularly around how the relative and the ultimate interact. I think the other three of the five houses are just named after one kind of founding teacher. This was all kind of after the fact. At the time when they were alive, they weren't called five houses. Later, people started observing these unique styles of Zen and said, let's call that a particular style called Cao Dong. But Cao Shan, I think, named himself after the six ancestors' creek, Cao Xi, Cao Creek, named his mountain after that in honor of the sixth ancestor. So we can also really say that the Cao Dong school, especially since the order, it's not the Dong Cao, you know, like Gui Yang, it's not like teacher and student, so it's a little funny there. Is it really named after Cao Shan, or is it named after Dong Shan and the sixth ancestor? So there's some debate. The name Soto, is it based on Sozan or Cao Shan, or is it based on Soke, the sixth ancestor? I personally like the story that is based on the sixth ancestor because he's such a wonderful ancestor. His teaching is so, I feel like, really forms the basis of our understanding of Zen. And also, Cao Shan's lineage died out very quickly. You know, we don't recite his chant, his name. He's not in our lineage. Yun Yang was the disciple of Dong Shan that passed the Dharma down to present times. So this thing about verse about poverty, right? And then I grant you've realized Tathagata Zen, but you haven't seen the ancestors' Zen even in your dreams. So Xian Yan then composed another verse. Okay, let's try it again. Third time. I have a function. It's seen in the twinkling of an eye. If others don't see it, they still can't call me a novice. I don't know if that's like, they still can't call me a novice. I almost thought, like, if I was writing it, I thought that it would make more, it would be more clear and compact to say, they still can call me a novice. I have a function, it's seen in the twinkling of an eye. If others don't see it, they can call me a novice if they want. It's fine because I have this function and it's playing out all the time. In other words, and maybe kind of referring to his Dharma brother who keeps like pushing him, right? You can say I don't have ancestor Zen if you want, it's fine. I'm just living this life. But anyway, when Yang Shan heard this verse, he reported to Gui Shan, it's wonderful. Xiang Yan has realized the Zen of the ancestors. His Dharma brother finally approved him. So that's the extended version of this story that Dogen tells here. That's Xiang Yan's early days. Still maybe living on this, old memorial site of this teacher. that maybe a new temple grew up there, and later Xiangyan had this assembly of people practicing with him, and one day entered the hall and addressed the monks, saying, "The way is attained by means of enlightenment and is not found in words." So this was still his thing that he was going to keep emphasizing. "It is mysterious and majestic and without the slightest breach. Don't belabor your mind. Just turn the light inward. Turn the light around. Shine it back. Those disciples using total effort every day to realize enlightenment are just backward and confused." So there's a little Sashin advice as we make this total effort in Zazen. It's not about struggle, and it's not about trying to fix the external situation of what seems to be our state. Is not a matter of fixing some external things, but turning the light around inward, which is very gentle. Could be, I mean, effort is involved, but not like struggling effort. And it's a very still, peaceful, stepping back, letting go. That's turning the light around to shine back on the source. Also, the teacher Xiangyan had a verse that said, "The chick pecks from within, the hen from without." You maybe heard about this phenomena of breaking out of the eggshell as a teacher and student. The teacher pecking from the outside of the egg and the student pecking from the inside. They can't quite meet. They're separated by a shell. It seems to be between them, and they're trying to break through it. Both, and it takes both. And apparently this is how it works in the world of chickens. It takes two to break the shell. The chick pecks from within, the hen from without. The chick breaks free through the shell. When hen and chick are both gone, the function has not gone astray. Singing the same song, the mystical voice goes on alone. When the shell's broken and the chick and the hen are both gone, but the function has not gone. Then they sing the same song, the mystical voice going on alone. Yes.
Can you say some more about that? Particularly in the context of the story.
Yeah, I mean, it isn't necessarily directly related to the story. It's just a few other anecdotes of Xiangyan. But, oh yes. Yeah, it's kind of funny that he, you could say his teacher, Guishan, first peck from the outside is like putting aside all your past studies. Just tell me directly now, say something about your face before your parents were born. That was like one big peck on the outside of the egg, right? Maybe he felt like they weren't really meeting as directly as they could. And we could say the peck from the inside from Xian Yan, the chick, was searching through all the all his commentaries, trying to find an answer to meet his teacher, actually, right? To try to meet, he went through his usual way, trying to find something there, and not finding it, you could say, burning the books and becoming a oatmeal and rice serving monk was also kind of like a peck from the inside. We didn't really hear about his teacher's response to that. We didn't say, "Oh, really? You burned your books?" There probably was more interaction there, but you could say there was a back and forth thing there, right? If it wasn't for his teacher's big peck of saying, express something directly, then he wouldn't have made that major shift, right? So that was like a major kind of like push from the outside. And there was a major response. He wasn't like, "Oh, well, I can't answer. Never mind. Let's just keep doing my thing." He really, really turned him, right? You could say the shell was really being like pecked at from both directions. And then he left. So, yeah, how does that part relate?
Sending his Dharma brother to check it out seems like a
continuation. Oh, yeah, right. So, right, the teacher sending his student. It sounded like it kind of came more from the student. "I'm going to go check him out." It was a feisty character, Yangshan. But, yeah, they were still interacting from afar. It's an interesting thing in this story in general that there's this distance now, but they're still interacting through the student coming, and also before that happened, through saying, at the moment of realization, saying, thinking at that time, if my teacher had said something, it wouldn't have come to this. So like this big gratitude arose after the fact on a distant mountain, and then offering incense, you know, formally bathing and offering incense, kind of like a transmission ceremony almost, bowing to his teacher on the distant mountain in gratitude. So there was still, that was like the final peck maybe. The final, or maybe that was just an expression of after the shell is broken. The gratitude that arises for what he was earlier resentful about, probably, and complaining about, his teacher wouldn't help him out. Maybe that's why he left to go live in that hut. So I think at times of peace for us, when our mind opens to the okayness of everything, gratitude is a natural arising, and often looking back at all the conditions that led up to this moment, that seemed like kind of a struggle and difficulty in the past, they all make sense at such a moment. We can be grateful for all those difficulties because they all led on this particular winding path up to this moment. So nothing was extra or missing in all those trials and tribulations. So the pecking could be, you know, a really specific back and forth conversation again and again. But all these Zen stories seem to be about there's this interaction trying to break through the shell of separation from two sides in conversation. Anyone else have any pecks?
It would seem that the final peck
Mm. So he has these various interactions that occur that are kind of leading to this place. And so the final peck comes from where?
Yeah, there's the chick, the hen, and the pebble. Yeah, in this, in all the stories in here, that's what's unique about this particular essay of Dogen's, is that's unlike most other Zen stories where there's just the chick and the hen. Here's this chick and a hen and a pebble, or a chick and a hen and a valley stream, or a chick and a hen and a peach blossom. So yeah, the final peck.
That's coming from the way.
The way, and you could say that includes the chick and the hen. And it seems that these stories are told with this background to see how all this effort before that moment went into this practice. In all these cases, we didn't hear about Sudongpo's Zen background, but we did hear the background that he had just been listening to the story about the teaching of the non-sentient beings expounding Dharma just before he got the peck from the mountain stream.
And we heard that he was a literary genius.
Yes. Maybe not necessarily sutras, but maybe poetic, literary. Yeah. So it's still, there's teacher and student, and then there's the conditions of the moment. That even when it's, even in the story where it just seems to be a teacher and a student interacting, still, they're never in a vacuum. There's always conditions there. And these stories are just interesting because they're often the, one of the people isn't even physically present at that time. They're still part of the story of that three-way dependent co-arising of everything, but it, including three major peckers. Yes?
The koans always tell the story of the big event.
Yeah.
Happening, but it doesn't tell us the years and years of practice.
Yes.
And conversations.
Yes.
That went before.
Yes.
And there were probably many hundred key phrases.
Yeah.
That the student just was not ready for.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's part of what Dogen's going to keep bringing out through this whole essay, is that it's not just a matter of these spontaneous events that come out of nowhere, but that, yeah, there's great diligent practice and struggle beforehand in all these cases. And you might have been talking to particularly, Zen was just beginning in Japan at this time, right? He was like, Buddhism had been around a long time, but these strange Zen stories were a new phenomena in that country. So people hear stuff, just like in America, we hear the story, the pebble hits the bamboo and there's great awakening. I think we love those stories because it seems like that could happen to me, like, any time. It doesn't say anything about great struggle. So then there's Dogen's going to start, after celebrating these wonderful, amazing stories, then Dogen's going to say, and then there's like getting down to this real work, which is the whole second half of this essay about repentance and vow. So one more story about Xiangyan, which is actually, it's one of my favorite koans, and I didn't realize it was the same person. You can kind of see, like, this is how he was. He's no longer. He's just trying to help other people reach this place of just directly experiencing the present and expressing it, because that was his the thing at the beginning. And his teacher said, even if you realize this. This place before your parents were born, say something about it. Express something. So he came up with this koan. That's case number 5 in the gateless barrier, Namu Mankan, called Xiang Yan's Person Up in a Tree. And this one. It's just like, I think I like it because it's this whole issue of koan practice, which is about being in a conundrum and having to express something. It kind of like consolidates the whole issue of koan practice into a very simple situation, but it's really like, what do you do? So Xiang Yan said to the assembly, "What if you're hanging by your teeth from a tree on a 1,000-foot cliff with no place for your hands to hold or your feet to step on?" Of course, you'd have to have a really strong jaw, right? And how would you get there? But he puts you there. You're there now, right? This is the issue. You can't grab the branch. You can't grab the trunk with your feet. And you're hanging over this 1,000-foot cliff. All of a sudden, someone on the ground below comes up and asks the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West. Which is the classic Zen question. Where it says, you know, "Excuse me, sir, I've heard that Buddha has some great teachings and I'm really suffering. Will you help me out?" That'd be more generic way to say it. But and maybe the teaching schools, that would be the way to say it. But then maybe we'd have a different conundrum. That would be like a Tathagata Zen story. But in the ancestor Zen story, it's like, what's the meaning of the ancestor, of the original Zen ancestor coming from India to China? Thomas Cleary likes to just take out that story and say, what's the living meaning of Zen? It's this kind of interpretive translation of that question. So if you respond, you will lose your life. All right? And if you don't respond, you do not do justice to the question. Or you'll be evading your duty as a bodhisattva who vows to save all beings through answering such a question. So you're stuck, right? At just such a moment, what would you do? What would you do? "Excuse me, all you people hanging from branches." What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? There's a bandit coming after me, right behind me. I have to go really quick. I gotta go quick. Tell me. Please. Yes.
So I'm hanging by my mouth for the thing, and the person.
Boom! You're on the ground. It's too late. Yes.
Okay. But I have something I want to say. I would go.
So we had one, and one.
Yeah, mouth closed, chomping on the rope.
Oh.
I hang on the rope, and I would go.
Thank you for your responses. I feel relieved and at peace. In fact, the bandit's gone. And now I can live the rest of my life in deep gratitude for your teaching. So, when he presented this to the assembly, the senior monk, Hu Do, came out and said, he had a different approach. He said, Master, let's not talk about being in a tree. But tell me, what happens before climbing the tree? And Xian Yan burst into laughter. So that's, it's like he puts you there, right? And I think that with these kind of koans, you have to like, you have to take them seriously. You have to, you know, okay, I'm really there. Like, how can I respond? But the response doesn't have to be like this either or thing. Koans are set up like that. They're set up with like a dualistic situation, and you know, like speech and silence are both wrong. What can you say now? So we have, you know, we have to respond in some way that's outside the box, and to say like, let's not talk about being up in a tree. It's kind of leaping out of the situation, right? And you can do that. The teacher could say, no, you are in the tree. And then he'd say, come off it, teacher. I'm not in the tree. And then the teacher might laugh again. Yes.
Well, you say this is one of your favorite koans.
Yeah.
So I take it you've contemplated.
Yeah.
What comes up for you, or what has come up for you in your life as you work with this?
That place where we're totally alive and can't do anything and yet must do something, like it's like a there's the wall, the barrier of every moment, and so when we seem stuck, when I feel stuck, there's just that bird singing. It doesn't have to be any particular thing, and it doesn't have to be really dramatic. But the stuck place, it's about being in a stuck place and seeing how we're not really stuck. We're not really stuck. Stuck. It's a setup. This, in this case, a setup from someone outside, but sometimes, or usually, the setup is created by ourselves. We set ourselves up in it, like, I'm so stuck. We feel. So, you know, there's no, every situation is unique in bringing out the response to the present situation of feeling stuck. So let's keep practicing that way. And I'd like to keep practicing that way. You know, so I haven't done like formal koan training where I've been demanded to give a response to that particular story. So just sitting with that story and feeling the shift, it being in that place and feeling like letting go when we're stuck. And if that's in zazen, it's not going to be very loud or anything. Right? It could be just a very quiet letting go.
I said this little story maybe a year ago, or I can't remember when, so some people may have heard it. It was a session at Tassajara and Yuri Roshi. And actually now I'm in the better position, because last time I told the story I was over there, so I couldn't quite tell it right. But anyway, I think it was a ceremony after session, and where people ask questions. Mm-hmm. So the question that somebody asked him, what would you do if you saw Bodhidharma coming down Tassajara Road? And so now I'm in the right position, so Katagiri Roshi looked out the window and said, I don't see him. And that was...
Yeah. Yeah. Let's not talk about being in a tree or why did you put me on a branch, teacher? Why did you hang me on a branch, teacher? Or the air is crisp on a February day. May your good health continue. Yes.
Why aren't we stuck when we think we're stuck?
Well, why would you be stuck when you think you're stuck? How could you be stuck?
Well, sometimes I think maybe I'm not stuck because the bell's going to ring or change is on its way, you know? But I think that's the easy way out.
Yeah, that's the easy way out.
And that,
that's still stuck until the bell rings.
And that maybe just like the person hanging from a branch by their mouth, maybe how that situation isn't necessarily real. Maybe the situation while we're sitting is awesome. Maybe that's not real either. Or, you know, it's not the way I'm...
Yeah. Or at least the way that you think that you're stuck in zazen is a mind-created place.
And that at some other point, before I sat on the cushion, I thought that the cushion was going to be a place of not being stuck.
Yeah.
And you sit down, you find out you're stuck. But then you're not stuck because you're going to hear the bell.
It's just another... The cushion is just a especially nice... place to think that you're going to get unstuck, because once you get there, it's harder to distract yourself from feeling stuck than it is when you're like, well, I'm feeling stuck in my life now, and instead of going to the cushion to get unstuck, let me just have a drink or watch some TV or something. I don't feel stuck anymore. So the cushion's a really good one, because you go there to get unstuck and then you really feel stuck. Or you really get in touch with your stuckness. So and then get to really see how the mind creates that. And we all have our unique stories of stuckness, but not good enough. That might be a big one for maybe almost everyone. On the cushion or off the cushion, but on the cushion. Yeah. Yes?
For me, a big question is if the stuckness and the release from the stuckness is conditions outside. Because that is depending on a condition. Or if I just say, oh, I'm stuck. Because I stuck myself. Mm-hmm. I can unstick myself.
It's not that it's just you that can do something, and it's not that just the bell ringing can do something. Just like it's not just the hen, just the chick, or just the pebble. It's like the whole situation. And each situation is going to have different conditions. So it's an interesting point again about conditions that's going to come up more in the story, that if it's a freedom that's dependent, or awakening or a freedom that's dependent on particular conditions, then it's not reliable, right? So like there's this Tibetan saying I really appreciate, that's like, when the sun is shining and my belly is full, I'm a Dharma practitioner. But when hard times come, then I'm just an ordinary person. Kind of like when things are just, when conditions, so it's about conditions are really well, nothing's really pushing me, so I kind of feel like I'm enlightened. Right? No problem at all, but it's just a matter of conditions. If they shift a little bit, then that feeling of peace and unstuckness is immediately shifts. So it's unreliable. So the freedom can't depend on particular conditions, and yet it is a matter of particular conditions. That's the funny thing. It's like, it's a matter of particular conditions, but not these particular conditions. Maybe that's it. That a moment of freedom is free in a set of particular conditions, but not these particular conditions that we chose or that we prefer, whatever. Does that make sense? It's kind of like it's in the dependent arising of the moment, but it's not dependent on, maybe to make it more clear, we could say, this moment of freedom depends on conditions, but it doesn't depend on particular conditions. Yeah.
Desiring certain conditions to set me free?
Yeah.
That doesn't work.
Yeah, right. That's why, like, we think, like Austin brought up something about, you know, whether you have to go somewhere, go to the monastery or the mountains or something. You know, if it relies on those particular conditions, then it's somewhat unreliable. And yet, because that we're always in the midst of some conditions, then that's as good a place as any. Like, we have to be someplace. So, but if we can see that that the particular conditions don't aren't the significant thing, then we're really freed on that spot. This has been a challenging one for me over time. Really, I spent so much of my practice life trying to set up the best conditions for practice. And like, you know, being stuck in that, like, in a kind of obsessive way of, or maybe you could say, like, distracted from my present practice by thinking about how the conditions could be different. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of time and energy. That, but again, looking back now, I don't regret it. It was like, that was, because all that was part of the conditions of right now. So, it's all okay, but thinking of my mind at that time, it was just not content with, I thought there must be something better. It's very easy. I mean, in the world, you know, outside of practice, in the world, that's how our whole, how sentient beings operate. It's always about, our whole life is about like moving towards better conditions. And even if we say that it's in the name of saving all beings, benefiting others, still it's like us manipulating our particular conditions to do that for really our happiness is kind of at the bottom of virtually every decision, right? So, and then if you get into spiritual practice, it's like the whole setup just gets transported over to that, and then it's like, still, how am I going to create the best practice situation for me and my practice? It's impossible, I think, to get out of this kind of thing, but meanwhile, there are really great conditions in, like, a sesshin, for example. However we got here, thinking that it would be helpful or not. What a blessing to have a bunch of quiet time and Dharma companions to help us. Yes?
Well, yeah, I appreciate that you said that, because I was just thinking that you know, conditions can be real teachers and nourishing sources. Like I'm thinking of the Ehe Koso Koso Garmon, you know, that confessing and repenting in front of the Buddha, you know, one receives profound benefit, you know. And so I think that there are these conditions that we can petition in a way, or make ourselves open to receive. And I don't know if that's the same as, you know, this, the delusion of trying to set up the perfect conditions. But then there's also something to be said for setting up nurturing conditions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think sometimes we aggravate our pain by not paying attention to the conditions that we're putting ourselves into. And so part of healing sometimes can be actually consciously choosing different conditions. I mean, I know there's something to be said for just riding along through the chaos with whatever, and that's one way to practice.
Yeah.
I think there's also benefit.
Yeah. Maybe two different levels.
Of conditions.
You could even, like on a more practical and conventional level, then yeah, we do have, there's certain things that are supportive to practice and certain that aren't. So we always, that is important to acknowledge that, because we do, we have to decide, we have to be somewhere and do something. So let's choose what we are guessing is the best possible situation. And then within that, then a kind of maybe deeper level or something, then we see that actually, ultimately, at the bottom, it's not really about that in the end. So, and I was maybe coming more from that place. The people who are already like stuck in the conditions of Sesshin, who chose such good conditions to be here, then we can say, actually, it doesn't matter where you are. But maybe we don't tell that to somebody who's like, at least we don't tell right away to somebody who's like hanging around outside the door. Should I come in or not? I don't know. And there are some. Let's see. Here's just some Dogen stories in the same vein. As I remember, a monk asked an ancient worthy, "Is there Buddha Dharma or not on a steep cliff in the deep mountains?" It's again this issue of non-sentient beings teaching Dharma. Is there Buddha Dharma or not on a steep cliff in the deep mountains with no people around and teaching Buddha Dharma, no sutras and temples and so on? And that teacher responded, "A large rock is large, a small one is small." That's the Buddha Dharma on a steep cliff in the deep mountains. Another little twist on non-sentient beings teaching Dharma, or maybe another way to put how non-sentient beings teach Dharma: a large rock is large, a small one is small. Dogen says, "My late teacher Tian Tong Ru Jing said the question about the steep cliff in the deep mountains was answered in terms of large and small rocks. The cliff collapsed, the rocks split, and the empty sky filled with a noisy clamor." That's what Tian Tong said. And then Dogen said, "Although these two venerable masters said it this way, I, Ehe, have another utterance to convey. If someone were to ask, 'Is there Buddha Dharma or not on a steep cliff in the deep mountains?' I would simply say, the lifeless rocks nod their heads again and again. The empty sky vanishes completely. This kind of expression is an affair existing within the realm of the Buddha ancestors. What is the reality of such an affair within the steep cliff in the deep mountains? So I would say to this person, the lifeless rocks nod their heads again and again, and the empty sky vanishes completely. But this kind of expression is in the realm of Buddha ancestors. What's the reality of such an affair within the steep cliff in the deep mountains? Dogen pounded his staff once and descended from the seat. Dogen pounded his staff once and descended from the seat. Dogen says at another time, the arrival of geese and the flight of nightingales are both the Buddha work of Shakyamuni at Jetavana Park, where the Buddha taught. Another teaching of nature, the non-sentient, well, maybe sentient, geese and nightingales. But the arrival of geese and the flight of nightingales are both the Buddha work of Shakyamuni at Jetavana Park. The opening flowers and reddening leaves are nothing other than the family style of Bodhidharma at Shaolin. People who have fully attained like this directly mount the sounds and straddle the colors, transcend seeing and go beyond hearing, and freshly join with others. People who have attained like this, in the Bodhidharma's family style of opening flowers and reddening leaves, they directly mount the sounds and straddle the colors. And it's like riding a horse of sound and color. Transcend seeing and go beyond hearing and freshly join with others. Tell me, what were the practice activities of Vibhashin Butsu, Buddha, Vibhashi Butsu, the ancient Buddha of past eons? After a pause, Dogen said, movement and appearances uphold the ancient road, no longer sinking into debilitating activities, which is another translation of this, of Xianyan's verse. Those who have mastered the way may call this an unsurpassable activity, is Xianyan's verse when he heard the pebble. So just another translation is, movement and appearances uphold the ancient road, no longer sinking into debilitating activities. Oh, actually, there might be the part above. It's of struggle no longer needed, I will follow the ancient path, not lapsing into quietude. It says it's from this verse, but it's so different from this translation. Not sinking into debilitating activities, right? Not lapsing into quiet function. Following the ancient path is upholding the ancient road. So the family style of flowers and leaves and geese and nightingales flying, and then Dogen asks, what were the practice activities of this ancient Buddha before Buddha? So he quotes Xianyan's verse. Following the ancient path, not lapsing into quietude. In other words, it's not just a passive thing. It's not just a nothing. It's expression. It's life. Zazen is very dynamic, alive, function, harmonizing, and is silently and stilly. It looks like it's very passive and quiescent. And yet we're harmonizing in this really dynamic way with the... Is it a gull? A crow. We're singing together with it. And it's maybe asking us, why did Bodhidharma come from the West? And are we like set up in a kind of this stuck situation where we're like stuck on the cushion? So us hanging from the mouth might be like we're stuck in Sasheen's schedule. But it's lunchtime soon. But before it's lunchtime, how can we be free in a way that doesn't depend on a particular condition of it being lunchtime soon? Lunch will come, and then we'll be stuck in having lunch, and stuck with whatever gets served to us by that gruel and rice serving monks. And our own, and stuck figuring out how to like slip the gomashio bowls into their like set up place really harmoniously, and these other questions, not get stuck by any of that. How do we do this? How do we do this? What should we do next? What should we do now? Are we stuck? Do we have to do something? Sky has crept under the cracks of the Zendo door, swirling around Manjushri, singing a song of winter, a pocket full of rye. May our intention equally extend to every being in place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. The illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.